So the one, like I said, I'm involved, Deb McCullough and several other people are involved in this working group, involved with coming up with some kind of number for the impact of forest insect diseases. And I think the real motivation that Nature Conservancy has in this is they want to be able to make some arguments about policy. That is, that, you know, we're losing so much money from insect diseases, we could, it's worthwhile to invest more in things like exclusion of pests. And basically, the way the state of the art currently, there are a couple of papers by David Pimentel published, which are much broader questions looking at the impacts of many non-indigenous species. But he does have, he presents a number in both of these papers of $2.1 billion annually for the impacts of non-indigenous insect diseases. It's a, if you look, or this is actually just insects, if you look at his papers, there actually aren't many details of how he came up with those numbers. So there's probably a lot of progress that could be done in maybe making a more logical approach to understanding the economic impacts. And my guess is in the end, we may find that the impacts are much greater.
Well, when feeding in larger groups. So we don't have to go very far from forest entomology to know that there are many examples of bark beetles that are aggressive tree killers. And one of the things they do is they attack these trees en masse with the specific purpose of overwhelming post-tree defense. In terms of avoiding being eaten, the concept there is that there's a failure to satisfy predators. And if you think about all the functional responses, type 1, 2, and 3, they all have the same phenomenon, regardless of whether they're linear or nonlinear or sigmoidal, that they do at some point, you know, predators can only eat so much food. At some point, they just can't eat anymore. So certainly low-density populations would be one that would be less likely to satisfy predators. There's also species that sort of work together in groups to detect predators. There's also cooperative examples of cooperative anti-predatory behavior. Antelopes have certain pack sizes where they're more likely to confuse predators if they're in larger groups. One of the really cool example of insect defense is honeybees that thermoball. Basically, if they get a predatory wasp in their hive, that they'll surround the bee, flap their wings feverishly, and basically cook the wasp to death. Certainly, something that would require some number of individuals. And in no way do these effects occur individually. So there are plenty of examples where multiple effects can occur at the same time. African wild dogs are a great example, which is probably why they're on the fast track to extinction. They're obligate cooperative hunters. They hunt in groups, and that's a very important concept of how they hunt. They also cooperatively breed. Not only are they less likely to be successful in smaller hunting packs, but smaller hunting packs, even if they do kill something, are more likely to lose what they've killed through kleptoparasitism. Usually hyenas will come along and sort of push them out of the way and take their kill. And lastly, ideally, some of the pack would stay to guard young. And not being able to do that, you sort of lose your young towards probably hyenas as well. Certainly examples of that in insects been shown in the monarch butterfly, that if butterflies that are small overwintering groups, they tend to have mating depression in the spring, they're less efficient at diluting predators, and they also have decreased protection from the cold. So once again, an example of multiple mechanisms of the Ali effect doing some considerable having some considerable influence on the dynamics of this population. There's also some other mechanisms. Inbreeding depression certainly would be more of an issue in lower density populations. I'm not going to go into these in too much detail. Environmental conditioning, more geared towards aquatic species that are able to condition the aquatic environment. And the last one's kind of a cool concept, anthropogenic effects. And if anybody's seen the movie The Freshman a long time ago, that would explain the anthropogenic effect or anthropogenic Lee effect. And in the movie, there's one last Komodo dragon on the Earth, and there's this group of people willing to spend lots of money to be one of this group of people to eat this individual because it's the last one. So the idea is here is that humans put sort of this inflated value on species as they become more rare. They sort of value them as some sort of trophy or so forth. So that's an interesting paper. You can take a look at it, but it's certainly, I'm not going to go into more detail there. So it still brings us back to this concept of the Ali threshold, where that populations below some threshold will be driven towards extinction. If you look at this is just the size of the population, and this is just the size of the population the following year or following time step relative to the initial, and one, of course, would be if the population is just replacing itself, and here's a carrying capacity, but at some point, populations start experiencing negative population growth and are slowly or quickly driven towards extinction. And there's actually been a number of attempts to empirically estimate, and this is certainly not all of them, this is just the ones I sort of grabbed together at one time, and so there's been quite a bit of interest, mostly from a conservation biology perspective, but certainly within invasive species, we've been tackling this concept as well. But there's plenty of examples where they've actually come up with a number, like queen conch, for example. They won't even bother trying to breed in small groups. They won't even bother. So there's certainly many examples in that respect. So Sandy sort of brought up the picture of biological invasion, so I'm going to spend the last bit of my time talking about how Ali effects sort of influence our perspective and management of biological invasions. And I'm not going to go into the different stages. Sandy already did that, but I'm going to focus more on specifically how Ali effects sort of influence or play a pretty important role in both the establishment and spread phases of the biological invasion cycle. We don't have to go too far. We can just look at situations where we've tried to establish something. In this case, this is a really interesting paper by Byrne several decades ago, where they have, here's a case where we're trying to establish these natural enemies. And in each case, it's not too terribly surprising to see that the fewer number of individuals that were released, the less likely that natural enemy population stuck. And so certainly shouldn't surprise anybody in this room. In the same token, we can look at the flip side and look at something like the European spruce bark beetle, which is always coming into the country. Bob Hackett had a really nice paper showing how many times it's been intercepted, and keep in mind from Sandy's graph how little of the freight gets inspected. God knows how many times it's actually been here, been detected, or actually been transported here, but it's never really established itself. And there's several potential Ali effects that could play a role, and Jean-Claude Gregoire from the Free University of Brussels has been doing quite a bit of work on that. Once again, there are one of these organisms that attacks live trees through the aggregation of large numbers, collectively overcoming host tree defenses. And they also have this mass foraging behavior, which Jean-Claude has outlined really, really nicely. And just the fact that they have a tendency to disperse in terms of finding hosts, it really means that the initial founder population site has to be pretty, pretty large, more so than something like gypsy moth, where we've seen outlying infestation started by a car with some egg masses underneath. This would be one that has a very, very strong Ali effect in terms of the founder population size. I sort of put together a really quick model using a pretty simplistic model, just assuming logistic growth, local dispersal, and stochasticity, and I'm also adding in this long distance jumps. And what I did is sort of I varied the strength of the Ali effect. So I'm basically saying there's very, very little Ali effect here, and there's a very, very strong Ali effect here. And this is where you sort of look at this as this is where the population is currently. And I think I did click the mouse here. Oh. Well. Okay, here we go. So you can see if you have you certainly have local dispersal here, but by having these Ali effects, you get a completely different picture of range expansion or spread of a particular organism from a starting point. And you can also see quite a bit of spillover, which is not very surprising as well. So certainly, theoretically, and this has been shown before, my simple JPEG builder, it's been shown quite a bit to play a pretty important role in how organisms spread once they do become established. And we've done some of this in gypsy moth, where we've been able to model come up with a proxy to represent the Ali effect and also the strength of that Ali effect, and then using data from the Gypsy Moth Slow the Spread program, which is a very comprehensive monitoring program, we can relate that proxy for Ali effect strength relative to how fast it moved in that particular year. And what we've seen, regardless of different invasion dynamics and different types of susceptible hosts in different areas in which gypsy moth is invading, we get a pretty consistent pattern relating spread. So LE effects are very, very strong. It moves very, very slowly. In some cases, it actually goes back. And Derek Johnson, a colleague with Sandy and myself, we actually took this. Derek took this a step further, and what he did is he noticed that counties quarantined for gypsy moth had a cycle in themselves. And even if you took away some of the political reasons for why we might see cycles, and what he did, he took the lead and saw that if you did both in empirical data as well as a theoretical model. What explained these pulses was an interaction between specifically an Ali effect and this concept of stratified diffusion, which is very applicable to a lot of biological invasions. It basically describes local spread as well as long distance spread, whether that's anthropogenically driven or through atmospheric transport mechanisms. It was really the interaction that explained some of these pulses. So, you could argue that the LE effects influence both establishment and spread of invasive species. They can be, you can make arguments that they're dynamic in space and time. And you could also make an argument or deduce that because of this, one important consequence is that you get complete variability in the rate at which species invade and also the habitats are susceptible to invasion. And in doing so, realizing the importance of Ali dynamics, you could probably make an argument that maybe